T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
It's time for MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run, the official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Host a local event and give kids in your community a chance to compete in the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 MLB World Series. Sign up for free at pitchhitrun.com.
This is Gresh and Keith.
Abby, look, I'm not trying to take credit of it, but, you know, I said something the other night. Yeah, he delivered in great fashion.
You know, like I said, outside noise is always going to be there.
And I know he heard me. I know he heard me.
Andy Gresh.
Here's a drive to right field. This has a chance. It's way back, and it is gone. Back on it is Santander. Gone.
This is Crush. Back goes Mullins to the wall, and JD has a three-home run game.
He's on a mission to prove people wrong, but he's locked in.
Rich Keith.
Matsuyama is Japan's first Masters champion.
Gresh and Keith starts right now.
It's crunch time.
Taco!
What now?
On WEEI.
Into hour two on this Monday. Thank you for joining us wherever you are on the WEEI Sports Radio Network. Today is NHL trade deadline day. The Bruins have already made trades for Taylor Hall, Curtis Lazar, and they get defenseman Mike Riley from Ottawa. Those all went down last night. Red Sox are on the road. They'll play Minnesota this afternoon. In fact, we are off an hour early today here on WEEI. I'd hand it off to Red Sox baseball a little after 1 o'clock, and the Celtics are out on the road. But, you know, we're not going to forget about football. And, Keith, it kind of feels like right now it's sort of the calm before the
storm. A
little
too calm.
Yeah, it's
a little too calm right now.
Mm-hmm. In the world of the NFL, where next Thursday it'll be round one of the NFL draft. And that's what we jump into here talking about the Patriots, because there are two corners on the Pats where you wonder about both of their futures. You wonder about both of their immediate futures. And we're talking about Stephon Gilmore and J.C. Jackson. J.C. Jackson, of course, has the restricted tag on him, meaning the tender that was put on him. He'll make about $3.3 million this year. And we know Stephon Gilmore, final year of his deal, $7 million. But those are two dudes that you might be able to do something with. So
you might have to do something with, by the way.
What gives?
Well, first, let's start with J.C. Jackson, because over the weekend on his Instagram, I know you like to follow all the athletes on social media, Gresh. You have to do it.
I live on social media.
We got to figure out what all these emojis mean and everything else. Well,
adoration of Twitter.
He had an Instagram story.
Yes, sir.
Where?
Oh, boy.
He wrote in all caps, "Gotta feed the fam."
Cry face emoji. Cry face emoji.
No, he didn't do cry face emoji. He said, "Gotta feed the fam. This bigger than me!" Exclamation point! Exclamation point! So that was from J.C. Jackson.
This bigger than me.
Yeah, he's trying to feed the fam. He needs to put food on the table for the family, so he needs to cash in. So you have two corners under contract for the upcoming season who both want more money. J.C. Jackson, much younger than Stephon Gilmore. Gilmore, much more proven, and I think even right now, still a better player. $7 million for Stephon Gilmore, not going to get it done. J.C. Jackson under that restricted tag, so it'll be kind of interesting what happens going forward. But both are at some point going to get more money. The question is, will it be by the Patriots? Which leads me into my draft theory now, Gresh.
Okay, at 15?
They're taking a corner. They're taking a corner. It's right in front of us. It's right in front of our faces. Maybe. Or they'll take whoever's still there, because we talked last week about all these mock drafts have one defensive player in the top 10, and a lot of times it's Micah Parsons, the linebacker. So now Caleb Farley and Patrick Surtain or J.C. Horn, all these really good corners, first-round graded corners, are kind of falling in the draft. The Patriots could take them. And again, I say that because they will often grab a guy when you think it's a position of strength, or in other words, not a position of need for this year. but they're thinking about for next year already. And I could see them doing it. Remember, they drafted Nate Solder when they had Matt Light.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've drafted guys when you're like, oh, they don't really need a corner, do they? They signed Stephon Gilmore the year that Malcolm Butler was still on the roster, and they didn't even get rid of Malcolm Butler.
But the next year,
they knew it. So I think
gone.
It's down there. And so you can also kind of work in this rookie, whoever it might be, and maybe Jackson and Gilmore are still on the team for this year, but either one or both might be gone because they don't want to pay them, and so they'll get the cheaper version, the younger version, through the draft. Because we're all saying, get a quarterback, or, hey, a wide receiver might be available. A stud wide receiver could be there at 15, or, oh, this guy, that guy. It's going to be a corner, a position that you think is already good. Because, oh, by the way, in free agency, they didn't really address corner. I know Jalen Mills can play both, but he's kind of all over the place,
well,
right?
They're kind of loaded when you think about it. With Gilmore, Jackson, Jones has been, for as much as he can get abused, he's really the consistent third corner. They started to work in Jawan Williams, the second-round pick from a couple years ago. And then when you think about just that configuration of the secondary, you have some safety guys who you think can kind of come up and play the run. That's where Duggar and Phillips maybe factor in. But if you have to have McCourty as a safety match up against somebody on a certain play, he ain't going to get smoked. Now, I think that leaves no room for Jason McCourty, although if it's $1 million, they might bring him back and say, okay, this gives us even more flexibility. And I didn't really love the way he played towards the end of the run, but secondary is a strength. But you have now,
sniffed it out.
No, that's where
they're going.
But you know what you've done is it's a part of the secret sauce that makes Bill Belichick really good in terms of fans would look at it and scream, need. Like I heard him on the morning show today, you know, with the whole, well, how come Belichick hasn't just drafted a guy? Maybe Belichick doesn't like any of these dudes because you're not a Sopranos guy, right?
I saw it all.
Okay.
It's not my favorite show. I know people love it.
But, all right, do you remember when Tony's sort of counterpart ended up dying and his son was around, right? Richie, I think it might have been the name. And he said to Ralphie Cifaretto, when he was thinking about killing him, said to Ralphie, more is lost with indecision than the wrong decision. That's the polar opposite in the NFL.
Wise words.
Because in the NFL, if you make a bad decision there, you know what you are? You're the Jets, and you're getting rid of a guy to draft another guy at the top. And I think that's what Belichick is more concerned with, the whole, okay, everybody just wants me to get a guy. He thinks he can manage Cam as much as we think that's flawed, but if he brings in the wrong guy, that is destined to set the franchise back. So, to your point, where are those guys that are on one-year deals who might go? And not for nothing, man, J.C. Jackson, shut up! For this reason, Rich.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't really help him right now.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, I don't know what it helps.
He doesn't have any leverage.
No. We saw Malcolm Butler go through the same thing. You should kind of take a page of the Malcolm Butler playbook, to be honest. You might want more money, you might want more. But it'll be there. It will be there eventually.
Yes.
Right now, I don't know if that is alluding to a holdout situation. That hasn't happened very often in New England. Logan Mankins is the one that really kind of, and he had much more of a track record behind him, too.
And that got to franchise tag
and that
level.
Got ugly.
This is JC. You have no other option.
No.
We gave you the second round tender.
Right.
Take your $3.3 million, sign the tender, and then go handle your business and to get paid next year.
Butler got his boss to send me my money, man.
That's what they're saying. Butler got his money, you know, eventually. Not here, but he got his money. But that's why I think, because this year we're so focused on, all right, how can this team be really good in 2021? But Belichick's also, again, with the exception of quarterback, I guess, also thinking about the future. And if he knows that there's going to be a problem with Gilmore, there's going to be a problem with Jackson, Jackson's probably like, hey, pay me my money. All right, we're going to take a first rounder. You'll play this year, and if you go somewhere else, fine. Like, okay, we got Caleb Farley. You know, he's the best corner in the draft. And that's the other thing about it is, it also checks off the value box because the best corners are going to get pushed down the draft because of the wideouts, the quarterbacks, Kyle Pitts, Penei Sewell, like all of those guys and certain needs there are going to push down these really, really good corners.
Now we're on to something at 11:09 with Gresh and Keefe on WEEI, the WEEI Sports Radio Network. You can listen to us wherever you go on the Odyssey app, or you can watch us do this show, weei.com/watch. The value game, value is a very open-ended word because however you want to take it, for Bill Belichick's end, they might be sitting there at 15, and to the point that you just made, it's, oh my God, this is a top eight guy on our board that's here at 15.
Right.
But there's also the other way of looking at value, which is we have all of these players from 8 to 20 that are still on the board at 15. Why wouldn't we just kind of kick it down the road a little bit and maybe slide down four or five spots to be able to get some extra currency to move around? So doesn't the value really lie in the mindset of Bill Belichick in terms of how they see it and what tickles them? Are they going to be more tickled by the group to slide down or the one guy that shouldn't be there? Either way, It is a definition of value that they can stick to.
Well, they can at the end of the day say we got our guy way, you know, lower than where we thought he was going to go, and whether they added more picks by trading down or not. And again, we've talked about this a lot since we've started the show. It's not something that I think is a great draft strategy. You're basically letting other teams pick the guys for you. So say they have the three corners there, the three guys that are like mocked a lot in the first round. Do you like them all? You really like them all equally? Like, that's such a cop-out to me. Like, shouldn't you like one more than the other? Same thing with the quarterbacks. If you're ranking the five quarterbacks, shouldn't there be a gap in between each one? Like, do you love one, really like one, kind of like another, don't like? Like, that's how I think it should be. Not, whoever the other teams take is fine because we'll get our guy in the end. I don't like that.
But I think that's where some teams end up factoring need into talking themselves into something that they probably shouldn't do. And yes, I think there is a little bit of the fan mindset where we look at it and it's, oh my God, they have to do this. Or it's, Hey, if there's a giant hole, then, hey, I like this guy. He might be able to plug it. They have, I think by now, people would have gotten hip to the game that over 21 years of Belichick, that they don't see need as the reason for drafting someone. And that's what makes it difficult,
right?
Because then it comes down to, as you said, this guy was 8 on our board, this guy was 10 on our board. Oh, wait a minute, there's a whole bunch of those guys that are sliding, and then you do the quick look, and it's, well, Chicago's a bunch of idiots, who knows what they're going to do, and you start to look at some of those teams that might draft on need, and then you're like, all right, this guy's going to slide five spots because nobody else is going to take him because they don't have that need.
Well, it's also another reason why I think it will be corner is because you look at all the mock drafts that we've looked at so far.
Yeah.
It's quarterback, wide receiver, linebacker, because that's what people from the outside view as the biggest needs
Patriots. Here we go.
So they'll just take for need. It's like, well, Bill also doesn't just think about what the team needs right now. It's best player, but also he's willing to bring somebody in that might not start right away. Like, a lot of our mindset is, oh, first round pick, that guy probably going to start. Yeah, on some teams, but for the Patriots, like, maybe they'll sort of work them in a little bit slower, and they'll be, you know, eventually they will take over the job. So I could see him doing that. But I also, to go back to the point about, you know, need or value or whatever else, if anybody that they have on their top 10, which I would love to see, by the way, it would be a great exercise.
Unbelievable.
If they could tell us who their true top 10 players are.
And when you see only one quarterback there and it's Trevor Lawrence, yeah, you're like, throw your coffee cup across the room.
But if any of their top 10 guys are just available at 15, take them. That's what I was saying. Take them. Don't do the, ooh, that guy's there, I can't believe he's fallen to 15. Hey, maybe he'll also fall to 20 and we'll get an extra pick. And then he ends up going 18 and you're like, oh, that's all right, we'll just take somebody else. Like, well, no, you apparently love that guy. He was in your top 10. It's your value, the most important thing to you. You got the value at 15. Just take the player.
See,
be committed to the player.
You also hit on something, though, and that is I don't think they fall in love with players. And that's a part of why Belichick has...
But shouldn't you?
Well, yes and no. Yes, you would think you would fall in love with a player and you might connect to them individually. You might connect to their game, but then you maybe either talk yourself into or out of, okay, well, how would this guy really fit here? Because if you draft a corner, that means they have then thought about either Gilmore or Jackson in a way where they're going to replace him. And that doesn't mean that Jonathan Jones can't be replaced, don't get me wrong, but it's if they go that route and they stay at 15 and they take a corner, then something has already been decided on the roster. And that's where I think some fans sort of have a disconnect, because it's easy to fall in love with the prospect of what someone could be until you're the guy who has to make the pick, has to fit them in, has to justify their existence on the roster. And that's where you start to get into some of those mind games a little bit. Like, I think for us, it's easy for us on the outside to fall in love with a perception. I don't think they fall in love with any of these guys, because look at what even Belichick tried to do with Brady. Even with him, it was like, dude, there's a shelf life.
That's
so
everybody,
we're looking at it as if we're trying to get laid and finding the hot girl at the end of the bar like John. Whereas with
take her to the park.
Whereas with Bill, he's like, eh, give me some. I'm fine.
Now,
either way.
Going back to Gilmore and Jackson, do you think they're both on the team this year?
I do. Something tells me that they'll figure this all out. Like, Jackson's already capped. They can figure out what they want to do with Gilmore. And I just can't believe that J.C. Jackson didn't learn the lesson of Butler.
Yeah,
I
mean, going down the same road.
Because
it seems like
he has nothing to complain about. I get it that he doesn't have the long term. It's like the discussion about the quarterback. You don't have a long term answer. My God, what's going to happen? I can understand J.C. Jackson's house.
Yeah.
You know, he's probably looking around and they're like, hey, man, what's your future? You know, if he's thinking straight, it would be, well, I'm going to make $3.5 million this year. That's my future.
Well, I also,
and then go play great. He's going to talk his way into ticking them off to where they're going to be like, dude, who do you think you are? You think you're Stephon Gilmore and you're going to get $85 million?
That's it.
Get the hell out
they're
of here.
They're in very different spots. And I'm usually a pro player because, again, the way that league gives you the fake money contracts and then cuts you at any time. And
yep.
You're like, wait a minute, I thought I was making this much. And like, oh, see you later. They're asking you to take pay cuts, all this other stuff. I would be on Gilmore's side if he wants more money. Now, he may not get it here, but I understand where he's at. He's like, I'm 30. I'm a corner. I don't have much more time. By the way, I'm better than all these guys who make more money than me. He'll have a list. His agent will have the list and be like, oh, really? So he has more of a, all right, I need to get paid now than Jackson does. Like, Jackson, he needs to look at not just Malcolm Butler, but how about the history of the Patriots with some of these rookies? Vince Wilfork, first-round pick, played his ass off, played way better than his contract. He went all the way up to the last year of his deal before they extended him. And that almost got ugly, too. There have been other guys. They did kind of surprisingly give Gronk and Hernandez extensions before they got up to the end of their deals. But a lot of they did. But lot of rookies.
But that also was keeping the QB happy. There was an
extenuating. Sure.
To me, there was a little bit of an extenuating circumstance.
But they've made rookies in the past go all the way to the end, and especially somewhere like J.C. Jackson, who, again, I like. He had a bunch of picks last year. But I don't know if he's a number one corner.
Well,
you
might have just made the point there. Think about it. And I know the Hernandez thing. We know that was a tragic ending, and okay, there were a lot of mistakes there. But they realized Gronk was a planet player early, and it was, okay, let's Nomar this guy and buy him out of some years of free agency.
Right.
And the fact that they haven't done that with really
– they don't.
They might have done it with Hightower maybe. I can't remember the timing on his.
No, I think he made it to the end too. I'm pretty sure, because that was the same draft as Jones, and they traded Jones away because he was about to go into his last year of his deal. And then I want to say – because didn't Hightower take a couple of visits?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
So I think they did even with him.
Okay.
A guy they love.
So think about it. So one of the rare guys that they've said as a rookie we're going to extend you is a guy going to the Hall of Fame.
Right.
Now, we can look at debate whether Gilmore is, but he's also 30 years old, and you question being –
but I'm saying with Jackson, it's like you're going to have to wait.
They don't see J.C. Jackson as one of those guys, and I think that tells us a lot. I think that's a really interesting sort of thing that you bring up there in terms of they're not against it philosophically, but it's A, got to be value to them because look at the – I mean, when you look at Gronk's time here, I mean, they got to him about the same way they got to Brady in terms of the actual savings on the player.
Different level
because they
player
identified
too.
He was great, but maybe that's the sign that J.C. Jackson is getting is that, you know, hey, they didn't even put a first-round tender on him. They put the second-round tender on him, which we sit here and are talking about all these second-round picks and blah, 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 and Gilmore and things like that. There wasn't another team in football that was willing to look at J.C. Jackson and say, for a mere $3.4 million, that's our extra second-round pick to be able to make an offer to this guy.
Right. Well, $3.4 million at first, and then you know that you're going to have to pay him. That's sort of the thing with that. That's why it's probably tough to make that deal. But I just look back at when Malcolm Butler was going into his last year, he wanted to get paid, didn't get paid. And not only did they not pay him, but they went out and they signed Stephon Gilmore to the biggest contract for a defensive player in team history. So I could see now J.C. Jackson wants to get paid. He's on Instagram, wants to get paid. Do they pay him? No, they're going to draft a guy in the first round and say he's the future corner here on the team.
And look, with Gilmore, I'm comfortable giving him, you know, if he needs a three, if you got to tack on two more years to this year to be able to make it work, however you're going to
pay
the guy.
If it's really two more years?
Well, no, what I mean is that it's the way to give him, like, a signing bonus this year.
Yeah, I'm all good with giving him more money this year. Yeah, but
you have to structure it, and there's no way they're just going to walk in and say, here's more money for this year and not get some sort of give.
Yeah, they need to figure that out. And I don't know if it's the void year contracts and all that nonsense that you want to get into, but maybe.
And if the credit card comes due in 2 years when the cap goes up, then in theory, you would think you would be able to manage that. But the bigger question is, J.C. Jackson, what is he going to be looking for? And even Malcolm Butler, to the best of my knowledge, didn't get the Stephon Gilmore deal. He got a good one, but it wasn't top market.
I also wonder how the relationship is with J.C. Jackson and with Belichick and the team, because there's a chance that this stupid stuff could translate onto the field and get out of hand. Remember, even with Wes Welker, they franchised Wes Welker.
Mm-hmm.
They thought they were going to extend him. They didn't. Next thing you know, Edelman starting games over him. They were jerking him around a little bit. Now, Welker still had his stats and still had a good year, but it wasn't the same. And the Malcolm Butler thing, obviously you had the Super Bowl, what happened there, but it just got kind of – it impacted how he played, felt like. And you just hope that that's not the case with J.C. Jackson. I don't know if this was just sort of a one-off. Maybe somebody was in his ear and he just went on Instagram saying, you know, I want my money. But I don't know. If the team can kind of turn on you. We've seen it, and it could go kind of ugly.
Oh, and it wouldn't be we dislike the player. It's we dislike the player at the money he thinks he should get. And that's where the rubber meets the road with this organization. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned franchise tag in that Welker comment. That crossed my mind that maybe the play for Jackson, or he thinks that maybe the play for Jackson, if they're looking at a little two-year run here, is they put the second-round tender on me this year. Maybe they use the franchise tag on me next year.
Though.
Well, again, when you go back to, and I do believe Michael Holly might have written about this in Patriot Reign, and I know Scott Pioli has talked about this, when they get some of those guys on those like second, third, fourth-round contracts, and then it balloons at the end. Like if J.C. Jackson leaves after this year, they look at it as we had the player for 4 or 5 years, and here's the total amount of money that we paid, even if it spiked at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas someone like Gilmore is going to be valued differently, because when it says your name, .3, and that's when you get to 30 in league, you get looked at differently. However, I don't know. I have a sneaking suspicion that both are here. I am not as confident, though, that long-term that situation with Stephon Gilmore will be worked out, or that they even, unless he really squawks behind the scenes and threatens to hold out, if he's professional about it, I could see them saying, all right, $7 million, you ain't saying nothing, go play.
Well, there's so much attention on a potential Gilmore trade, I wouldn't rule out Jackson. We saw Chandler Jones get traded the year before his free agent year, and we saw Jamie Collins get traded at the trade deadline when he was about to become a free agent. And if J.C. Jackson's squawking about wanting money and everything else, maybe they'll say, all right, we can actually get more for you right now. We already drafted your replacement. We'll trade you, get another pick, a higher pick than the comp pick that we would get for you, and go from there. So I'm hopeful they're both on the roster, but I'm certainly not convinced.
Well, that's what I wonder, if Jackson might be starting to think, hey, if they draft somebody, then
writing's on the wall.
Well, not only is the writing on the wall, but if I'm the third corner and I'm not starting, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, like, now your value goes down.
They can start to manipulate that playing time a little bit. And I can understand why J.C. Jackson would be nervous. It's just foolhardy right now, because there's no option for him. And that's the thing I think an agent would say. It's like, hey, man,
what are you doing?
You're going to complain, and the only thing you're going to do is get these people aggravated at you. Gretchen Keefe rolling along on a Monday. Yes, we are keeping an eye on the NHL trade deadline as well. The Bruins have already made big moves. Taylor Hall, Curtis Lazar is already in. They get Mike Riley, the defenseman from Ottawa. So we'll see how that all works out for the Bees, as they are loading up for a playoff run. And good for Don Sweeney. Right now, let's trend.
We're back to Gresh and Keefe on WEEI.
Here's a drive to right field. This has a chance. It's way back, and it is gone. The Red Sox go back-to-back. J.D., his third pitch to J.D., and that is a hanging breaking ball ripped deep to right field. Does this have enough? Back on it is Santander. Gone! J.D. Martinez, a second home run today.
Swing. There's a drive to center field. This is crushed. Back goes Mullins to the wall, and J.D. has a three-home run game to dead center field over the 410-foot marker, 11-7 Red Sox. He launched it.
That's the sounds from Baltimore. Well, even though they were at Fenway, they were playing in Baltimore. The Red Sox sweep the Baltimore Orioles. They are now 6-3 on the year. And I know that Bob Radford on WEEI.com, and you know, we got a little for those who are watching us on Twitch, we're in a little bit of a different studio. Some maintenance gets done in our main studio where, you know, we're comfortable and spread out and everything. And our guy Eamon,
yeah,
who is the commander of the digital here, at least on Gresh and Keefe, he put his phone up to be able to stream you for Twitch, and all I see are a bunch of tweets and notices and things, and I've seen like three come up from Lou Maloney already with the whole "we did this in 2018 where everybody waited" and blah blah blah. I'm like, yo, Angry Lou is now turning into Manic Lou in terms of selling everyone on this baseball team. But what are the first impressions of this group? And as old Bob Radford wrote on WEEI.com, are they taking the sneaky out of sneaky good yet?
Well, they couldn't have started worse, right?
Correct.
And I think people were ready to say, all right, it's going to be another lost season. So the only thing they could do to get people interested again was go on a 6-game winning streak,
That's
which
right.
they've done. And so they swept Tampa Bay, give them credit for that. They get the 3 back from Baltimore, who, again, is going to lose 100 games. Remember we had the guy after 2 games who was like, ah, come on, Baltimore's the one that's sneaky good. It's like, shut up.
No.
They're not sneaky. They're terrible. But you're 6-3, and they have scored the most runs in the American League. Like, I think every team's played about 9 games to this point, so it's pretty even playing field. They have scored more runs than everybody else. We knew the lineup was going to be pretty good. And this is even, they have all these runs even after not scoring anything those first couple of games of the season. We're like, oh, I don't know if it's cold Fenway Park or what the issue was why they couldn't hit, but they're hitting the crap out of it. J.D. Martinez looks like he did his first year here in Boston. I think we knew they were going to hit. Where I have a slight pause about, are they good, great, playoffs, not playoffs, it's still the pitching.
Bullpen.
It's still the bullpen, and it's still the back end of the rotation, too.
Yeah.
And even the guys who are good, like how many Eduardo Rodriguez, Nathan Eovaldi starts are we going to get this year? This is a group of starters who never have 30 starts. They just don't. And that's why I laughed in Garrett Richards' face when after he got shelled in his first start. He was better in his second one, but he got shelled in his first one. And he's like, well, I got 32 more of these. Like, no, you don't. You never have. You never have.
Not pitching like that, you won't.
And I know one of your arguments could be, well, hey, you know, a lot of pitchers around baseball are fragile. True, but this group in particular, way more so. They just, you're going to get to a point where not just Tanner Houck, but other guys are going to have to get brought up. And then I don't even know how good Martin Perez or Nick Pivetta or Garrett Richards are on the regular anyway. So I still have, and then, you know, bullpen's a concern as well. So I know they can hit, but are they going to win 14-9 every night? Like at some point, the pitching is going to have to help them.
And last night should have been a night where the relievers could have had the day off. You're up 10-1 in the middle of that game, and you're thinking, okay, and then all the stuff, like I went away from it a little bit. I come back, it's 10-7.
Yeah,
and then
what?
It's like, yeah. And then I see on Twitter, the Red Sox Twitter put out, can't believe we're saying this, but JD has hit another one. And it's like, okay, what the hell's the score? And I think at that time might have been like 13-7
right.
or something
oh, yeah.
like that.
It was slow
and then
pitch
even
softball,
then, yeah, I mean, the final 4 innings of that game took forever to play because it turned into a typical Camden Yards type game where the ball goes flying out of the yard. And you would have thought that especially heading into this Minnesota group, who has been hitting pretty well, Buxton's as hot as anybody right now.
Yep.
You know that Minnesota, it, you know, especially at home, you would think, even though it's probably about 30 degrees up there today, who the hell knows how cold it's going to be in Minnesota this week for this series playing in an outdoor ballpark. But you would like to have been able to give those bullpen arms a little bit of an extra day of rest, and instead you got to get people up, you got to get out of jams, and maybe that's just the way this team is going to be this year. So there is reason for optimism, because if we agree that the Orioles are a bad team, they're going to see them a bunch.
Yep.
And there's a lot of other bad teams in the American League that, in theory, the Red Sox can take advantage of unless the fourth and fifth starter pitch like guys on those bad teams.
Right.
And
that, there's a
chance. And that's the real issue because you get that, and then all of a sudden Eddie Rodriguez has got to go down for 15 days and miss three starts, and that's where this stuff starts to pile up, to your point, Rich, to where the talent shows that you don't have enough on the roster to be able to manage it.
Well, and that's what we'll find out, too, about the rest of the American League. Because you remember a couple of years ago, there was like 300 or 400+ win teams in the American League. And everyone's like, oh, these are the best teams. Like, yeah, well, the flip side is there was a number of teams that were horrible.
Historically bad.
So I don't know how that's all going to shake out. I do feel like Baltimore's one of those teams. We'll see who else ends up being sort of the dregs of the league. And if you could take advantage of them, you know, beat up on those teams and then play roughly 500 ball against the good teams, that's the recipe for making the playoffs.
We used to look at it here and say, you've got 1 through 4 locked up in the rotation, get through the fifth day and then reset the rotation, and you know you got a lineup that can mash. And the thought process was always, well, these other teams have bad pitchers or average guys at 3, 4, 5. That's the worry for the Red Sox fan in me, is that if we were to apply the logic that we use when the Red Sox are really good and say that it's beating up the back end of the rotation, is this rotation going to be good enough to not fall into that category? Because you can have some faith in Eddie Rodriguez, who, by the way, spun the ball really well against Baltimore. He looked really good.
Yep.
But you mentioned Eovaldi as well. And you just wonder if it's going to be, when those two guys are on the mound, you think the Red Sox are okay. But when the other guys are on the mound, you're no different than those teams that you're trying to take advantage of when they're third, fourth, and fifth starters.
And so I guess that's where you go back to the lineup and say, all right, if it's, you know, starters 3 through 5 for you, not great. But no team, not many teams, I should say, in baseball feel really confident about guys after their first two. So that's where the line, like, those are the games you have to win 8-7. Like, those are the games where maybe the starter only goes 4 or 5. But guess what? The other starters are going to go 4 or 5.
And even the Yankees after Cole right now, right? Like, after Garrett Cole, how much confidence do they really have? I know there's optimism.
Yeah.
Now, again,
no, you're right.
That lineup compared to the Red Sox lineup, okay, it's a little deeper. It's a little better. It's pretty good. But that doesn't mean the Red Sox still can't mash. Look, J.D. Martinez is hot as a pistol right now. Mm. And it starts to look, it's looking like Devers is kind of finding it at the plate.
Yes.
I know he had a pretty good weekend.
Real slow start, so yeah, he's definitely bounced back.
Yeah, and they're going to need someone other than, you know, let's not turn this into like a Manny year where it's okay, let's get the number 4 hitter up or the number 3 hitter up, whatever
is.
And
no, they got
other guys. He's the guy who's able to just drive in all the runs. They're going to need plenty of production. Kike Hernandez is off to a decent start.
Yep. I mean, Vasquez.
My expectations for Kike Hernandez were not very high terms of him being a premier offensive player. And I do think the catching spot will level out a little bit, but there's every reason for optimism. And Rich, to the point that you made at the very start, it's kind of calmed everybody down a little bit. I don't know if people are ready to jump into the pool buck naked yet.
No.
But you're at least standing there looking in the water being like, hey, I might want to jump in on this team.
Well, 6 straight wins is nothing to sneeze at.
Correct.
That's a good winning streak. And so it doesn't matter if 3 of them are against Baltimore. So be it. You know, you're in first place in the division. And I know it's early, but again, if they were in last place, we'd be pointing that out.
I'll tell you what did it. I don't know if you heard about this, but I know that we have aggravated Alex Cora, who joins us every day after he's on with OMF.
Yeah.
Well, maybe, just maybe, it was this big pep talk after starting 0-3 that pushed this team to their success.
Blood alone moves the wheels of history.
Have you ever asked yourselves in an hour of meditation, which everyone finds during the day, how long we have been striving for greatness? Not only the years we've been at war, the war of work, but from the moment, as a child, when we realized that the world could be conquered. It has been a lifetime struggle, a never-ending fight, I say to you, and you will understand that it is a privilege to fight. We must never acquiesce, for it is together.
together that we prevail. We must never cede control of the motherland, for it is together that we prevail.
All I envision is, like, that's Merlone trying to fend off Patriot fans the last 5 years. You know, the whole, it's a privilege to fight.
They may never lose another game.
They may not.
You hear that after, you know, three straight losses, you're going to be pretty fired up.
I can imagine so. It's better than aggravated, Alex, in terms of motivating people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, motivational speaker Alex Cora right there.
Yes, exactly.
Well done.
The Masters, the thrill, the pageantry, the tradition, and some angry members at Augusta National? Got to ask an uncomfortable question next.
More Crash and Keith right now on WEEI.
It's okay. Right down to the wire. Who predicted that by one?
Matsuyama is Japan's first Masters champion.
That's what it sounded like on CBS over the weekend. A very anticlimactic final round to the Masters. Gresham Keefe here with you, WEEI Sports Radio Network. You can follow us on Twitter, and you should, at Gresh Keefe. Follow Keefe on Twitter at Keefe21, and you can get me on Twitter at The Real Gresh, G-R-E-S-H. He bogeyed the 18th hole, but it didn't really matter. Hideki Matsuyama wins the Masters. And, Rich, there's a couple of things that stands out to me before we get to the Matsuyama piece of this. Number one, just like with WrestleMania, which we'll get to a little bit later on, even a little bit of fans, oh my God.
So much better.
What a difference it made in the presentation on television.
Yeah, it looked good, but again, I think it still comes down to leaderboard. At least for me. I think the Masters and the other majors are where you get the casual fans, the guys that aren't watching golf every weekend or obsessed with what's going on. You dip in 4 or 5 times a year. And when it's a lot of guys that you don't really know, it hurts it. It really does. And everybody knew there's going to be no Tiger this year. But then when you look down, you're like, well, at least give me like a Phil or like a Ricky Fowler.
There wasn't
or like
a mainstream name. So there were names known so to Spieth, golf fans.
Yeah, so Spieth came in third.
Right.
But again, most of the time when you tuned in, at least when I tuned in, it would be guys that you hadn't really heard of. And you're like, oh, okay.
Who's Will Halitosis?
I don't know these guys. Like, you're looking in the top 10, and Spieth, I guess Patrick Reed.
Oh no, he's a big timer. Yeah,
no, I mean they're big time. Well, but like you know what I'm saying? Like, do they cross over for the casual fan? Probably
yeah,
not as much.
I think it's the tournament that sells the casual fan because the television presentation is so different. It's not bogged down in you know, here's Jim Nantz throwing it to the Capital One studio for whatever update, or here's Jimmy Myers or whatever. It's 4 commercials an hour and. I find it interesting from the radio TV nerd standpoint as to how coy they are in trying to slide in those plugs, right?
Because
you know, young Sheldon is getting mentioned on the damn Masters, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's not blatant, you know, like where they would have the guy walk onto screen and you know what I mean? Like some
he's
of the
got
stuff
the shirt on with Sheldon.
Like there's none of that. It's the whole, hey, young Sheldon tonight at the Masters, now the 16, and then it's Vern Lundquist again. So I do think there is a bit of a different profile when it comes to the Masters. But look, when it's final round and you've got, again, for me, I know this is a big deal, maybe not for some, but when NASCAR pushed back in Martinsville to yesterday, at least here we had, what, Bruins, Celtics, Red Sox on all day long?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all across the day.
Yeah, everybody was on. Right.
Right.
So they got swallowed up. I bet locally it did not do very well because you had every other team playing.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what the number is. And then you get to the Hideki Matsuyama piece of this. And is it terrible that the thought crossed my mind that here's this guy who was at one point the low amateur like 10 years ago. So he's not unknown to sort of the members of
golf fans know who he is.
But that membership in that Augusta National Golf Course, like, I wonder if there were a couple of old boys standing in the corner being like, I can't believe we got to get a translator for the guy that won our damn tournament. Like, I wonder about that whole overtone down there.
Well, when did they allow black members at Augusta? What year was that?
It was
in the 90s, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Or was it 2000? Like, no, 90s.
And then,
but like
Condoleezza Rice got in and others.
Yeah.
And this year they did have Lee Elder, who was one of the honorary T starters, even though he didn't hit a ball. He was there with Gary Player. And so I know that Augusta is trying to evolve, but it's terrible. Like the profile of some dudes sitting in the corner with their green jacket going, and I think there would have been a lot when Tiger won it too. It's the I can't believe this guy won.
Well, there I think there was it 97 when Tiger won his first time? Like so,
was before Augusta National even remotely started to get evolved when it came to racial equality.
So here's a little nugget here: the Masters, which was first played in 1934, didn't extend an invitation to a black competitor until 1975, and the club didn't admit its first black member until 1990. And didn't offer membership to women until 2012.
There you go.
So there's a little breakdown of that.
And I know that at one point when they started to offer membership to women, that's where Condoleezza Rice got brought in because they, you know, in their mind, they're thinking, hey, this will be good for us. It's terrible that I think that way, but it is a part of the history of that tournament. But, man, that golf course looks – I mean, like, it is amazing how – just pristine that golf course looks, even after guys have been traipsing all over it for three rounds, and you look at it, I mean, it's like you could putt on those fairways.
And I think probably more what they wanted than a year ago, because you remember Dustin Johnson won it at like 20 under par or something insane. Didn't he set the record
lowest score when they played it in November? Conditions were a little unique to that time of year.
And I think they didn't want it like that as much.
Agreed.
Whereas this, you know, Matsuyama was, 10 under? So I think they'll take that. I think they'll say, all right, this was a better showcase. You don't want it to be the most difficult thing in the world, but you also don't want it to just be like another tournament.
It doesn't need to be the U.S. Open where you hit a good chip and the ball's rolling off the green. I do think some of it is the competitiveness. Like, you have the leaderboard pulled up there.
Yeah.
It was 10 under, 9 under, and then third
7,
place.
7.
Okay.
So, too far, I guess.
Yeah, I guess I think what they also worry about, too, at the Masters is, like, the final round of the Masters is normally where somebody ends up having a meltdown. But when someone starts with a 4 or 5 shot lead, it almost takes that element out of the mindset of the fan.
Yeah,
who
Matsuyama was so good
in
round three that he played above par in round four. It didn't matter. Like, you know what I mean?
Do you have Patrick Reed's numbers up? The only reason I mention that is because I think, did he shoot 72 all four rounds?
No, he went 70, 75, 70, 69.
Okay, there was one player that they were mentioning who might have gone 72.
John Rahm went 72 the first 3 days and then 66.
Okay,
so that jumped him
so
up
that's
to fifth.
What it was.
That's
so,
what it was, John Rahm.
So Rahm was the one who kind of screwed that up. But I know they mentioned during the tournament as it was going on that Rahm would have been the first player ever to shoot the exact score all four rounds if he shot a 72.
I do think golf, and you know, they've had their issues post-Tiger anyway. Some of those tournaments that he's not in, you're looking for that next star. I think if Dustin Johnson, who won it a year ago, if he was in the leaderboard, maybe it's a little bit different. Or if you had a couple of, you know, younger guys that had either won before or gotten close before, you know, all that probably helps. But
and DeChambeau, who can hit the ball a mile off the tee, doesn't always know where it's going.
Right.
When he's right, he's dynamic. But the problem is when he's right, like there was a par 5 where I think he dotted it 340, had 160 to the pin, and then an easy putt for eagle. He's going to make a bunch of those and win by 10. It's unexciting golf as much as it's great that they can show the little line and the fact that he's hitting the ball 400 yards in the air.
Right.
Final hour of Gresh and Keefe coming up because at 1 o'clock, we're going to hand it off to Boston Red Sox baseball here on WEEI, the WEEI Sports Radio Network. For lunch coming up, Taylor Hall is here. But is Don Sweeney sending a statement to some of the veterans with the moves he made last night? That's next.